This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I sometimes feel that I'm in some sort of either a dream or a nightmare. I'm not sure.
We stand to watch our agricultural economies and even our human habitation, some places, disappear.
You know, we don't want to be a dump site in western North Dakota, not on Fort Berthold and not in western North Dakota. We value our land, our connection to our land as tribal members.
Tonight and tomorrow, gas flares burn over the dry and drier lands of the western United States. There is a fracking boom exploding rock 10,000 feet down and miles all around. In Colorado, North Dakota, and Wyoming, villages become overnight towns. Big trucks fill small roads. Gas floats over the prairies and the foothills. The last waters in great rivers, reservoirs, and aquifers is poisoned. 50,000 years worth in 10 years. Billions of gallons a day. It kills the ground it touches or disappears forever into the subterranean earth. As climate change works against the browning landscape of the American West, crazed humans use all the water they can find to make still more methane and carbon dioxide, to make more money with oil and gas. We will go to those sacrifice zones. You will hear four voices. The ranchers and a Native American woman are part of an organization calling for regulations and safety protection instead of the enabling state, where fossil fuel companies control the capital, selling the dream of wealth to the people while their environment careens beyond reclamation. Farming may collapse in places, and without drinking water, some communities will eventually leave too. It's happening all over the world, the invasion of the well drillers, coming as close to 500 feet to homes, like it or not. Ask the disgusted people from Queensland, Australia, about the fracking blight, or coal seam gas, as they would say. Get ready, Britain, where the government sees fracking as salvation for the economy. Eastern Europe will be conquered and fracked. People all over North America and all over the world need to listen to our speakers today, because when it's gone, it's gone. Our guest is Wyoming rancher Robert Laresh. Hello, Bob, and welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Morning.
Well, before we get started and your statement of concerns about the explosion of fracking in the West, let's talk about your previous experience in the oil and gas industry. What was your role in Alaska?
Well, I had several, but the one that was most closely related to oil and gas industry was a cabinet office, Commissioner of Natural Resources, they called it, in Alaska. As commissioner, I was in charge of the oil and gas industry, hard rock mining, coal mining, forestry, geology, state parks, water. It was a very broad portfolio in Alaska.
And were you also part of the Exxon Valdez oil spill cleanup?
And then years after I was commissioner, I was in another cabinet post that was called Exxon Valdez oil spill coordinator. I was the one who dealt with Exxon during that event.
Right. And now you're a rancher in Wyoming. Can you tell us briefly about your ranch, Bob?
Well, my wife and I have a small ranch by Wyoming standards. We lease to someone who runs cattle, and we have 260 acres of irrigated hay fields. And my wife and I have a truck garden. We grow organic heirloom vegetables, and she has subscribers to her community-supported agriculture group.
That sounds really good to me. We are in favor of that on Radio EcoShock. Now, Bob, you're a board member of the watchdog group called the Powder River Resource Council, and you also speak for that larger group, WARC, the Western Organization of Resource Councils. Why don't we start with your concerns in your part of Wyoming?
We in Wyoming, we've already suffered 12 to 14 years of watching our water disappear into the maw of the energy industry. But we're afraid that what's coming next and has started to come will be even worse. Our coal bed methane industry, CBM, drilled over 26,000 wells in the last decade, mostly in the Powder River Basin in northern Wyoming, which is where our place is, actually. Today, many have been abandoned, and only a few wells are still producing, mostly because of the plunge in the value of methane. The water disaster that followed CBM was a bit different than that which is starting to accompany deep horizontal drilling and fracking. CBM occurs in shallow structures, 1,000 to 3,000 feet, which hold coal and water. To release the methane gas, aquifers must be dewatered and the water somehow disposed of. In 1992, the Wyoming State Engineer, our water czar, issued a determination that pumping out and discarding fresh water to facilitate CBM production was a, quote, beneficial use of the groundwater under Wyoming water law. From that point on, the state engineer's office has permitted pumping unlimited quantities of groundwater just to produce methane. From 1997 through 2012, a minimum of 309 billion gallons of water was pumped out, mostly being dumped on the ground. Very little was reinjected, and that which was dumped on the ground destroyed pastures, croplands, and agricultural soils. This manic discarding of our very limited freshwater resources over only a single decade has already compromised some very critical resources for some cities and towns. The northeastern Wyoming of Gillette, ironically loving to refer to themselves as the energy capital of Wyoming, saw its primary water source drop by 625 feet in only 10 years. This is a groundwater aquifer. The shallower Wasatch Aquifer, which overlies the main aquifer, was mined down more than 250 feet. Precipitation recharge of these reservoirs is approximately 0.15 inches a year. Simple math tells you that it'll be 50,000 years before the Fort Union Aquifer is back up to where it was in 1997. But things can get worse, and we're afraid that they are. 300 deep horizontal wells have already been drilled in the Powder River Basin since 2010, and 1,000 more are already permitted. Bureau of Land Management estimates at least 3,800 will be drilled in only two counties alone before 2022, with tens of thousands more to follow in other counties around the state. Each of these will likely be fracked several times and consume, pollute, and remove from the hydrologic cycle an average of 4 million gallons of fresh water each time a frack job occurs. And we don't even know how much water we have to meet this demand. Recently, our organization prepared a report which we presented to the governor and the legislature. And this report summarizes a 7-point plan which we've created, which the state must follow to prevent a disaster of water depletion. The 7 problems we define briefly are, first, the state has inadequate knowledge of aquifer water levels and water requirements for oil and gas drilling and fracturing. Second, inadequate use of groundwater control areas, which is a regulatory tool which we do have, which allows the state engineer to prioritize uses when inadequate water is available. Third, the management and disposal of contaminated fracking flowback water and produced water needs much better tracking and planning for disposal and maybe for salvage and reuse of water. Fourth, there's been very poor permitting and inspection of deep injection well disposal of contaminated flowback water, and this threatens potable aquifers nearby. Fifth, unplugged and properly plugged oil, gas, and uranium or exploratory boreholes, of which Wyoming has probably more than 100,000, provide conduits for potable aquifer contamination from reinjection wells and frack jobs. Six, commercial oil field waste disposal facilities pose risks to groundwater, land, and wildlife. And finally, seventh, we urgently need research to develop new methods for water reuse and recycling.
Thank you, Bob. It almost sounds like Wyoming and the whole part of the West there is being used like a sacrifice zone for the energy needs of the rest of the country. Do you ever get that feeling?
Well, we use the sacrifice zone language a lot. There are environmental organizations which fight for the, quote, special places and don't seem to give a damn what happens to the rest of us. So, that's a very apt characterization, I think.
Bob Laresh, looking at the umbrella group that you're also a member of, would you care to make a statement on behalf of the Western Organization of Resource Councils?
I made these remarks when we released our work report about the problem of consumption of water by fracking. This is a very important study, we think, and through it we're hoping to call attention to a serious problem that's growing in all of our dry western states. In a nutshell, the innovative oil and gas production methods that are resurrecting our oil and gas industry and have brought America to the brink of energy self-sufficiency, a good thing, also have a very dark side. They're threatening to suck us dry of our limited water resources. There's been a lot of debate over fracking and pollution, and continues to be. But little notice has been given to what in the long term may be an even more serious threat. Unless our states take real action soon, we stand to watch our agricultural economies and even our human habitation in some places disappear. 99% of rural Americans rely on groundwater for their domestic needs, of rural Americans, as do 51% of all Americans. The new production techniques that promise to provide us with so much crude oil and natural gas involve deep, 10,000 feet or so, horizontal, a mile or more, wellbores, and hydraulic fracturing. The fracking process requires lots of water. 3 million to 6 million gallons per frack job. These new production methods require up to 40 times as much water per frack job as did older methods. Tens of thousands of wells will be drilled, and each well will typically be fracked several times. Once these billions of gallons of water have been used for fracking, and this is a very important point, they are then removed from the hydrologic cycle, never to be available again for any other uses. Where will all this water come from? And what will we do when it's gone? This huge demand for pure water, a resource that's obviously essential to life and to our economies, and its destruction in the course of one-time petroleum production, is perhaps the ultimate example of externalization of costs. From where they should logically be charged, that is the oil and gas producers and consumers, to today's general public and to our children. When the oil and gas are exported with no surcharge for destruction of our water resources, this immense transfer of wealth becomes unbearable. Welcome to the third world. In the work region, four states, North Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, and Montana, have allowed industry to drain irreplaceable groundwater resources to fuel fracking for oil and gas with little to no oversight, record keeping, or meaningful regulation. In the midst of record drought and record demand for limited groundwater resources, this drain on the state's water supplies threatens other industries, agricultural production, and the livelihoods of families. States often don't even keep close track of how much water is being used by the oil and gas industry. Resulting water loss threatens the future of other industries, agriculture producers, and families. States must immediately inventory their water resources and calculate the best valid estimates of demand from the energy sector. They must regulate water use in ways that logically prioritize access to this most limited of resources and that provide for the future. And states must require that oil and gas companies significantly lower their water use. Good economic and human health require it. And good engineering should provide a method to make it happen.
So what is the name of that report, Bob, and where can people find it?
The name of the report is called Gone for Good, and it can be found on the WORC website, which is www.WORC, that's WRC.org.
Thank you. We've been talking with biologist, former Alaskan Energy Administrator, and now Wyoming rancher Bob Laresh. He's a member of the Powder River Basin Resource Council at powderriverbasin.org and of WORC at WORC.org. Thank you so much, Bob.
Okay.
This is the Radio EcoShock Fracking Special with our four citizen speakers from the fracking lands of the American West. I'm Alex Smith.
We feel like we're natives, you know, and that we belong. And all of a sudden, all these other strangers are coming to town and coming from all over.
A different lifestyle than what we were here before, with some farming and cows and stuff, and now it's an industrial type thing.
It's crazy out here. The towns are not prepared for the boom at all.
We're leaving because you can't live like this.
Jobs are plentiful, housing is scarce, and towns are bursting at the seams. This is the boom behind the Balkan.
This University of Montana Radio Television Department production.
63 degrees right now in the Williston area. Expecting the same thing for Saturday and Sunday. Middle to upper 50s next week.
You know, Williston was a peaceful town. And, you know, we took everything for granted. I guess we could get across town in 5 minutes. And now the change has come, and it brought on, it came drastic, or what should we say, it just happened.
This is Radio EcoShock with a special on the dangers of the fracking rush in the western United States. Next up is a longtime rancher along the Missouri River near Bainville, Montana. Pat Wilson's family has been there for over a century. Pat can tell us about the oil and gas rush in the famous Bakken Shale Field and draining huge volumes of water from the Missouri River. Pat, welcome.
Thanks, Alex. Yes, I'm a fourth generation, I guess, cattle rancher near Bainville, which is in the Montana portion of the Bakken Formation, a rather large oil-bearing formation spread out over North Dakota, Montana, Saskatchewan, maybe a little bit into South Dakota. It's a tight formation, which means that the oil is firmly tied to the rock and therefore has to be accessed by means of hydraulic fracturing.
Right, and you can't really see it on the surface. It's something that's under the ground, and that's where it is.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's about, I think around, in my area, it's around 9,000 feet under. In addition to hydrofracking, what is used is called directional drilling. Here, the spacing unit is 1,280 acres. They'll go down, make a slow bend, and make a lateral into the Bakken and drill about 2 miles, you know, laterally, and then hydrofrack it and then extract the petroleum.
Well, why don't you give us an overview of your concerns with that fracking boom and the Bakken development?
The primary concerns that I have is the enormous amount of water, of fresh water, that's used. And not only used, but once it's used, it's gone for good. In Montana, there's about 11,000 active oil and gas wells, of which about 800 are out of the Bakken Formation. In North Dakota, there's many more. I think they've so far drilled about 8,000 Bakken wells. Hydrofracking involves forcing water mixed with a variety of different materials and chemicals under the ground at extreme pressures. And as the wells get bigger and longer, like I said, 2 miles long, they consume, say, between 1 million and 5 million gallons of water per well, and we're talking thousands of wells. Now, we're in a very dry area, and we also are adjacent to the Missouri River, which is a primary source of water for hydrofracking. We only get about 10 to 14 inches of rainfall per year, and so we rely enormously on the aquifers and the streams that run into the Missouri as well as the Missouri itself. Now, the high demand is triggering a lot of things. The state agency in charge of water rights in my home state, Montana, the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation, reported 13 illegal water depots just over the summer of 2012. Rather than reacting to that, instead of fining the entities illegally using water, they instead developed a bill that would allow for more water use for oil and gas. House Bill 37 was passed the last legislature and incentivizes the use of any excess water that current water rights holders are not using. In other words, water that was originally obtained for agricultural purposes can now be leased by the agricultural producer to the oil corporation for use in hydrofracking. In addition, more permits are coming. The agency's website says that 13 fracking water permit applications are currently pending in Roosevelt and Richland County. Over 70% of the requested volume slated to come from surface water. The industry argues that the amount of water actually being used still is a minimal percentage of the total available. Well, that may be true. I lived for a time in New Mexico, and I'm sure that same argument was made with great river systems like the Rio Grande and the Colorado until they are completely dewatered now, I think, by the time they reach the sea. The Army Corps of Engineers has plans to sell water to oil and gas companies from a number of reservoirs in Missouri, and I think we should be very concerned about this change. The organization I belong to, the Northern Plains Resource Council, notes another thing, and that there's no coordinated overview of water usage. Multiple agencies in Montana are responsible for different aspects of water law, and no single agency is addressing the cumulative water use by the oil and gas industry in Montana and its implications for state policy. Now, once this water is used, and I can't stress this enough, once the water is used for hydrofracking, a good deal of it flows back, and when it flows back, it's so impregnated with salt and chemicals that basically it's become a hazardous material. So after the water is used, it has to be taken to an injection well and pumped again thousands of feet under the surface just to get rid of it. So once the water is used, it is gone for good. It's taken out of the hydrologic cycle permanently. Now, what we're seeing is the tip of an iceberg because the companies assure us that, well, for example, they're planning 7 wells per 1,280-acre spacing unit in our area. So that would be like basically a 7-fold increase from what we have now. So there is a huge amount of water that could be at risk here.
The drought in the Midwest eased off in the spring of 2013 in places like Ohio, but it's still been very dry west of that. How long can this fracking industry drain away water resources before ranching or even human settlement becomes endangered?
I'm concerned about the, for example, House Bill 37 in Montana. I am very concerned about the precedent established there where we can start to divert water from agricultural uses over to the fracking industry, and especially if the drought locally in eastern Montana, two-thirds of eastern Montana is under a drought right now. Also, in addition to the Missouri, wells, dams, any kind of reservoir or live creek has been tapped for fracking, and that, I think, presents a concern, too.
Well, unlike many Western residents, Pat, you do own the mineral rights under your land, and you make some money from that oil. Why are you complaining now? What brought you to speak out?
It's true that we're making money short-term here in the Bakken area. I don't know if we have much choice because of things like forced pooling, which is like another story that I probably don't have time to go into. But fresh water, I think, is a commodity literally beyond price here. If we tamper too much with that incredibly precious resource, at the end of it, one fear would be that all we have is money, which you can't drink.
Pat Wilson, has your family experienced anything about the stress or pollution on a personal level?
Yes, we have. I'm not going to exaggerate it and say to a tremendous degree. We've had one oil spill on our place, which did, you know, briefly breach the containment area, was cleaned up. I think we pressured a little bit to have it cleaned up properly. There's been minor things along the way. A water tanker tipped over, and a small amount of salt water was spilled then. We've dodged a bullet several times. East of me, there was a significant salt water spill into a creek with, I think, something like well over 1 million gallons spilled there. This did not affect me directly, though.
And some big changes have come to that village of Bainville, Montana, the former population of 300. Do you want to talk to us briefly about that Alberta company, the trucks, the work camps, the subdivisions and all that?
Oh, I guess I could. Yes, a company called Procore essentially mines a kind of sand found in Wisconsin. which forms the basis for a substance called propant. It is the stuff that's mixed with water and forced through hydrofracking into the formations to sort of pry them open and keep them open. This company has set up in Bainville a huge depot offloading this sort of sand. It has transformed the face of this community almost completely. Our school system is pretty overwhelmed. Our sewer facilities are overwhelmed. We have two man camps now, one on the west side of town and one on the east side of town. There's talk for our tiny little village, which is sort of flabbergasting. They're talking of building a Marriott here. Some people project that our population will go from 300 to 5,000 people, which I think may be a little extreme. But judging from the increases I've seen over the last 2 years, it could be within the realm of possibility. Most infrastructures here are either overwhelmed completely or on the verge of coming unraveled.
Yeah, people don't talk about the social costs. I mean, you have a fairly tight-knit community. People know one another. Now suddenly there's strangers from all over the U.S., all over the world, coming for big money jobs on the short term. They're bringing their kids in and out of schools. It must be unsettling.
Well, it is unsettling for a native such as myself. I can spend an entire day in Bainville and not see a soul that I know. And that's a sort of wrenching experience.
Pat, do you think the Bakken Field is a bubble? And if so, what will be left for the next generation?
That's a good question. My son and I mull that one over extensively. It seems to me that Montana, sadly, is a resource-based economy. And built right into that, I think, is a boom or bust cycle. This is my own personal opinion, that sometimes things are ballyhooed to the skies in terms of production and sort of visions of a new El Dorado. I wonder if some of that isn't for the benefit of investors that the corporations are trying to sell on the idea of sticking a lot of money up here. Is it a bubble? I don't know for sure. I am profoundly uneasy about that.
Is there anything else you would like to add as we wrap up here?
If no one has ever seen a boom and all of the things that go along with the boom, it is unbelievable. I sometimes feel that I'm in some sort of either a dream or a nightmare. I'm not sure.
We've been talking with rancher Pat Wilson. His family has lived near Bainville, Montana for more than 100 years. Pat is a member of the Northern Plains Resource Council at northernplains.org. Pat, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We'll be right back with more voices from places invaded by thousands of fracking wells. Wyoming, Big Sky Country, is part of a sacrifice zone that helps heat our homes and power the barbecue cheap. North Dakota has been promised 7 times the wells that set the prairie on fire and set the climate on fire for centuries and longer. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. We return to our interviews of citizen activists speaking out against the uncontrolled violation of their lands and lives. We're going to talk with Bob Arrington. Bob is a retired engineer living in Battlement Mesa. That's in Colorado, where up to 200 natural gas wells have been proposed in that one area alone. Bob is chair of the Energy Committee of the Western Colorado Congress. He testified before the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Bob champions the health impacts of oil and gas, has led local air monitoring efforts, and takes international media around the gas fields. Bob, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's my pleasure to join you.
In a press conference for the new report, Gone for Good, you had serious concerns about fracking in Colorado. Please go ahead and tell us about that.
The forum that I spoke in before was primarily concerned about the hydrology and the loss of waters in the injection process and the poisoning with dangerous chemicals. So we have several problems here with the fracking and the flow back that comes from the fracking and the air quality measures and the water quality measures and problems that are just seemingly endless. And in some cases, there's control measures done, but not in all cases. So basically on that hydrology issue, we had a problem and a solution and an action that I had talked about. Colorado is a headwater state, and all the water flows out of it. So any water that we maintain is through reservoir systems or anything like that, but we have downstream commitments, and those people are also wanting good quality water as it goes down there. And so the competition for the water in this state is heavy, and yet we have a reservoir that is a flood control reservoir south of Denver that is 2,700 acre feet, and the amount of water that is used in fracking could, in 2012 alone, drain that reservoir in 1.25 years. Here on the west slope, almost all the water goes into our Colorado River, with the southern part of the western slope going into the Rio Grande River as major rivers flowing out. On the eastern slope, we have the Platte River and the Arkansas as the major drainages going out. So the amount of water that's used is just tremendous. Like I said, it drained that Chatfield Reservoir. And with the horizontal drilling, the fracking water requirements are going up to 3 to 6 million gallons per wellbore, as opposed to maybe a million used now. On the air quality, we have here in Battlement, we did talk our county commissioners into doing a health study for the effects. The end result was a McKinsey report that came out that said people were going to endure health effects at a half a mile away from the drilling under the present way they do things. This was also confirmed by a Theo Colburn study that not only confirmed the half a mile, but also confirmed some new chemicals that we hadn't seen before. But in this, as a solution, Colorado's got to step forward through their Colorado Oil and Gas Commission and tighten those regulations. Now, last year we did score a minor victory in the fact that we got a 500-foot setback put in, but by the same token, we had a ring of safety study that showed that 1,000-foot was more or less the minimum distance for damages. And if anything went on for 24 hours, such as a fire or incident, why, it could seriously damage property around. And our action has been to get the government and the governor and the COGCC to move forward on these and get the rules in place to make the operations far more safe.
First of all, let's talk about this 500-foot setback. I understand that some people in the states do not own the rights to what's under the ground. So that means that an oil or gas company could come right up to within 500 feet of somebody's house and just put in a fracking well?
Yes, that's correct.
And there's nothing you can do about it?
There's nothing you can do about it. Colorado is a split estate, as is most of the nation. So those mineral owners can get those rights. Now, the one thing that has happened is with the horizontal drilling, they can reach up to 2 miles or more in any direction out from the well pad. And slowly they're finding that it's more economical to set up once instead of moving the rig over and over again. Still, it hasn't taken effect. The distance was much less than 500 feet. It was 300 and 150, depending upon the circumstances involved. Now, the way the rule was written, of course, if a property owner agrees to them coming closer, they can even come closer than that 500 feet.
Well, that'd be some neighbor to have. It's noisy, it's dangerous, it's smelly. We can't see the methane or most of these volatile chemicals they're fracking with. I've seen video with special filters that show methane and other toxic gases just pouring out of these newly fracked wells, billowing out in clouds for as long as 2 weeks before they even cap it off and then leaking after that. What are the health impacts of breathing that stuff?
One of the big volatile chemicals that comes off is the BTEX group. And that's benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene. Those chemicals, the two benzenes are both carcinogens, and the xylene and toluene are both poisons. So it's a real mess, and those are the critical chemicals to watch coming off there. But they've got, I'd have to dig into the reports because the names get to be a mile long on some of the bad news chemicals. But in that TDEX report of Colburn's lists, what they found is an added thing. Now, Colorado has, and Garfield County has, scheduled a air quality monitoring setup. And the Colorado State University is coming in to perform that, and it'll be a 3-year study. However, of course, right now the drilling is in a slowdown because of the low price of gas across the nation. Then, too, the big oil rush up in North Dakota has taken quite a few of the rigs up that way. But the Niobrara on the eastern slope of Colorado has opened up oil there. So Weld County and the counties over there, they've had quite an air quality problem going on. It's the type of thing that NOAA got into the thing and seen these high concentrations of like benzene and whatnot, and they attributed it directly to the drilling programs going on there. As far as methane, the methane, as far as a human problem, is it's not a toxic gas in any way. But what it does do, if as they lose 6 to 12% in gathering and getting this stuff into pipelines, it adds to the global warming thing because methane is 20 times as powerful as CO2 as a greenhouse gas. And it can reside in the atmosphere anywhere from 10 to 20 years.
And have people in Colorado complained about developing strange illnesses that they might attribute to fracking?
Yes, and this has been a real problem because people go to their individual doctors. The doctors are not quite sure because they don't know which chemicals that these people may have been exposed to or what they've got around. So the treatment thing can be problematic. Colorado enacted a rule by which they would have to disclose to doctors when they put together with a drilling operation or somebody poisoned in that way and they come in. But the doctors had to sign a confidentiality waiver and couldn't share the information. And there's been such a hullabaloo about that, why they relaxed the rule to say, well, we'll modify that you can share it with your other medical professionals. But it's been a real fight that way, and only now are the problems really coming to light because it's been denied, denied, denied by the industry.
Right, and people who do get sick, of course, they feel very isolated and it affects them financially. It's a very difficult problem to deal with. I'd like to get back to the water thing. I mean, Colorado, as you say, it's the beginning of a whole bunch of river systems. It's very important. I've seen photos from space that show that Colorado is generally drying out, probably due to climate change, but it also goes through regular natural cycles like that. Been tremendous fires in Colorado, and now we're removing this water. It sounds like a bad scene.
Well, yes, Colorado's experienced a heavy drought. Some of the peak temperature variations occurred in northeastern Colorado, and it went through the whole Midwest from Texas to Canada. It's been a real problem, and of course, what we've seen was horrific forest fires in the summer that we had, what was it, almost 300 homes or better wiped out last year from forest fires. And the Colorado, of course, would flow out there, but it does go dry from all the use that's put on it. And Colorado's bound by the Colorado River Compact to make sure that we don't hold back anything that would be allocated to somebody downstream. Now, the Rio Grande, it's another river that runs dry by the time it gets through Texas. So the Platte and the Arkansas do find their way to the Mississippi. However, on the Arkansas, Kansas had just a couple of years ago won a lawsuit by which Colorado was withholding too much water there and they had to release more. So we had to drain some of our reservoirs to get back some of that water to Kansas. And water is a major issue. And unfortunately, the state and the health departments have seen fit to put the allowable levels for some of the frack waters or produced waters from wells to be disposed of after minor treatment. As we found out in Pennsylvania, where they were experiencing more radioactive water coming out of there, the treatment facilities just weren't equipped to handle the radioactivity that they were dumping down in the rivers. They like to delineate produced water from their fracking flowback, but about 50%, somewhere close to 50% of their frack waters doesn't flow back immediately. It comes out over the life of the well. So these produced waters have heavy metals, arsenic, cadmium. They have radioactivity. They're a very heavy brine from the salts that are there. They're a mixture such that when they dump it on the ground someplace, it kills the vegetation.
Well, I thought all of that was being put back in deep injection wells, but you're saying some of it can actually make it into our river systems?
Yes, it can. And the deep injection wells is the worst of the worst of the brines. Sometimes here in Colorado, what they're doing is they're recycling it some for rework fracking or whatnot. And after it's been recycled once and then it comes out, they almost always have to take that and put it in the deep injection wells. Now, that water, once it goes into deep injection wells, it's gone for our lifetime unless somebody comes up with the technology to draw it back out and remove all those poisons and toxins and carcinogens from that water. Some processes like reverse osmosis and stuff could, but it would be cheaper not to use that water in the first place. Just as a minor note, they can frack with liquid natural gas itself. They can also use nitrogens, and there's a couple of other processes, but these are more expensive than the cheap water they can get.
Well, they're not really paying what that water costs. Bob Arrington, what drove you to become an activist and to speak out about this?
Well, as a retired person and getting involved in this and seeing the technology that is available that they still won't use and how slow they are in responding to that and our needs for the gas and stuff right now, I started getting interested as an engineer. I said, why aren't these problems being taken care of? So first off, you end up identifying the problems, and then once you see the magnitude of those problems, you say, wait a minute, this has got to slow down. This has got to stop until we are ready to do it right and responsibly. And of course, you know, bottom lines are the biggest driving force in any sharply run company, and unfortunately, those profit margins is what's causing our problems out there in the health and the contamination of the environment.
You've been listening to Bob Arrington. He's a retired engineer in Battlement Mesa, Colorado. He's the chair of the Energy Committee of the Western Colorado Congress. Bob, thank you for telling us what the big energy companies don't want to tell us.
All right, my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Radio EcoShock, Fracked Lands and Fracked Lives. I'm Alex Smith, as our special continues. Beyond the old-time ranchers, humans have been living in the American Northwest for more than 10,000 years. Theodora Birdbear is a lifetime resident of the Fort Berthold Reservation. She serves on the board of directors for the Dakota Resource Council. Theodora, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Well, please go ahead and tell us what you think people need to know, what they aren't being told about this big oil and gas boom in North Dakota.
Yes. You know, the Missouri River is the major river in western North Dakota, and it's the source of drinking water for me, my family, and most of our tribal members on Fort Berthold. And that's in addition to the many communities up and down the Missouri River. Groundwater is a limited source in our arid, dry country in western North Dakota. And with billions of barrels of oil projected out here in the Bakken, the oil industry is looking for a source of fracking water. According to their own projections, they are just starting to frack and drill out here. There was a news article in one of the statewide newspapers this winter that the North Dakota Industrial Commission director said the plan was to drill and frack every square mile out here in western North Dakota. Your listeners probably know that fracking is a part of a unconventional process, and it requires millions of gallons of potable water to extract the Bakken oil. But because there's never really been any planning in the Bakken oil field development in North Dakota, no, there's no state, no federal, and no tribal agents that is monitoring or measuring the loss of potable water from oil and gas development in a very arid state like North Dakota, which is also experiencing drought conditions out here in the West at a minimum. And it's only based on estimates by the industry and the North Dakota Industrial Commission. They're estimating that fracking consumes 2 million gallons of potable water for each Bakken well site. And when you multiply this times the number of wells that are currently producing in North Dakota, that's about 8,224 wells, you get an idea of the level of unmonitored industrial consumption of water. At a very minimum, that's about 16 billion, with a B, gallons of potable water used for fracking so far. And this is in a very arid region in the middle that's also experiencing a drought. So the drilling and fracking is just starting out here. I think one of the reasons why maybe the public isn't really aware of the volume of potable water being lost is because the government and the industry likes to measure the water loss impacts in terms of acre feet, and few people in the public really understand what an acre foot translates to. The extreme consumption, industrial consumption of this potable water comes at a time when the snow melt into the Missouri River has been declining, and I believe this is due to climate change or global warming, and I've lived in Mandaree most of my life. And over the years, I witnessed the change in shorter winters, less snow, and hotter, drier, and windier summers. So in that regard, on Fort Berthold, we've experienced a high number of prairie fires last year from oil well sites. And we also live in an arid, windy, dry area. So out here, it's a very, very rural area. We need a reliable and permanent source of water out here to fight fires and protect lives. In addition to the high consumption of water by fracking, there's a dramatic increase in population also occurring in western North Dakota brought on by the Bakken oil field development. And this population growth is another new demand on the Missouri River, and it's only going to continue to grow in the years ahead. Our state and federal political leaders seem to think that natural resources, including water, are unlimited in arid country like where we live out here in western North Dakota. And this kind of thinking allows the industry to consume billions of gallons of potable water for fracking without really accounting for their immediate impacts or potentially long-term impacts. So we need to responsibly conserve water for the next generation to come, and we need to determine what are the actual water resources available today. For us, I think in the United States, this means that the U.S. policy needs to support an energy conversion to a renewable energy opportunities that already exist in this country today. In the United States, 5% of the renewable energy capability exists just in Indian country alone. And North Dakota is also one of the windiest states in the nation, so we could do better, and we need to do better in North Dakota and in the United States. And in North Dakota, especially in western North Dakota, we really need to protect our primary source of drinking water, which is the Missouri River. Right now, we need to address the water quantity issues that are identified in the work report, Gone for Good. And we really do need an impartial study of the current water resources that are available out here in North Dakota.
And when I think about all the roads, the trucks, the noise, the dust, the breakup of habitat, I've got to think that the animals are suffering too.
Oh, yes. You know, I live out in the Mandaree area on Fort Berthold. We're the largest land base here on Fort Berthold. Prior to 2007, we were very rural and isolated area, and I think we were undeveloped from industrial development, and this was really kind of a habitat sanctuary for animals and endangered species. But I was talking to the tribal fish and game director probably last week, and he said it's hard to find any deer out here because all their habitat is now being invaded by well sites out in the Mandaree area.
And there's a lot of small plants and small animals that we don't even know about, and we should know about it, but I'm presuming that nobody's even looking at that.
You know, that's part of the unplanned development that's going on out here in western North Dakota. There was just a rush for development. The populations had not, you know, were struggling economically. And I guess, you know, people reached for the money that they saw that was going to come, but it was never factored in. What are the unacknowledged costs that we will be bearing in the future from this development? And we still don't. You know, we're seeing them today. I see visible impacts. I'm in the targeted area of development on Fort Berthold, and I see some prairie fires from the open flares of the well sites. These flares go 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and it's a very dry country. I've seen two prairie fires about a mile or two from my house, and they threatened nearby the homes of tribal members that live there. We've had a really big fires last summer. So there's a lot of unplanned impacts that people are now experiencing. There's a lot of emissions coming from the open flaring of this natural gas. Because there was such a rush to develop it, there's not any mechanism to gather that natural resource. And so it just flared into the open air. It's not reinjected into the well. There's no pipeline system here, but pipelines have their own issues also. So, yeah, there's going to be impacts on human health here, and there's a degradation of air quality. And I was at a meeting last week on pipelines, and folks were talking about the loss of quality of life out here in western North Dakota that's being destroyed by this development.
We've built up a picture of Native Americans having a special connection to the land as a sacred place. Do you think that sanctity and relationship is being violated?
I know it's being violated. I think there's in a community within Fort Berthold, there was an attempt to put a oil waste dump site in that community without their knowledge. The effort was to try to get it into the community without any public notice, and attempted to avoid public comment that was required for that dump site. However, people got wind of it. They knew something was going on. There was a very big excavation process going on, but nobody could finally, probably about 4 weeks later, people found out it was a oil waste site, and they rose up against it and really put the pressure to stop that site. But there's all kinds of that kinds of activity going on in the state of North Dakota. There's a lot of radioactive fracking waste that's coming out of the Bakken Shale, and that's kind of just come into becoming visible to the public this year. And now counties are being asked to change their zoning requirements to remove any restrictions on radioactive waste. And small communities are fighting this, but you're fighting a big industry and a complicit government that is getting a lot of revenue from this development. Sadly, the state government, it's like in the center of North Dakota, and most of the population is in eastern North Dakota. They don't really see or experience the impacts that people that live in western North Dakota are seeing. I feel like it's not a priority to them, but, you know, we don't want to be a dump site in western North Dakota, not on Fort Berthold and not in western North Dakota. We value our land, our connection to our land as tribal members. There's a existing connection with our land that we still articulate in our hearts and in our beliefs. Sadly, our tribal government, the leadership is pretty much pro-development. Some of them have businesses in the industry. So there are some conflicts of interest that exist. That's an issue here on Fort Berthold.
Well, money's the big poison wherever it goes, I think. I'm wondering, this sounds to me, what you're describing, it's almost like another invasion by the white man. Am I going too far to say that?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, when I listen to, I'm a part of the Dakota Resource Council, and I attend the meetings on oil and gas issues and the pipeline meeting last week. And from the way people were talking about the effects they were feeling, I thought, well, they are just now getting a sense of what Indian people felt when the federal government pushed for folks to move out here, and how we as tribal members felt when our lives were impacted significantly. So the impact of invasion is very similar that's going on today, and that's another thing that we're also dealing with here on Fort Berthold.
Do you find that there's some wisdom from the elders that could help us cope with this?
I think what we need to remember is our connection with our land, that our land is really, it's life-giving to us, and we have to protect that relationship with it. That's what's going to save us. I just can't express that enough, that I think sometimes folks get, you know, separated from land. You live in a city, maybe, or you're not a landowner or a home out there in the country, but even the smallest thing, like having a garden, it connects you back with the earth. And I think you need to have your relationship with the earth needs to be alive. It needs to be active. It needs to be giving both ways. And that's really what is going to help keep us alive and keep us in good health with our environment. So we have an obligation to protect our environment. It works for us. It takes care of us. It's life-giving, and so we need to respect that relationship with it.
Thank you so much for saying that. I needed to hear that, too. From Mandaree, North Dakota, we've been talking with activist Theodora Birdbear, a member of the Dakota Resource Council. Theodora, thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. As the American West continues its breathtaking drought, what could be crazier than draining away the rivers, the reservoirs and aquifers to power the underground war of fracking, to poison the last of the fresh water? With the great rivers of the Colorado and the Rio Grande already a dry gulch before they reach the sea. All to fill the sky with more oily carbon dioxide and gigatons of methane, a more powerful agent of climate change. If you have oil or gas-bearing shale deep beneath your country somewhere, act early to prevent this transgenerational tragedy. See the new film by Josh Fox, Gasland 2. Organize your own groups. Let your elected representatives feel the heat. Protect your water, if you still can. Protect your climate. Stop this fracking madness. I'm Alex Smith. Try out our library of files at ecoshock.org. They are all free. You can donate if you want to. Look for my interview with Robert Howarth, How Frack Gas Ends Up Emitting As Much Greenhouse Warming Power as Burning Coal. That supposed clean fuel is a bridge to the nowhere of extinction. Thank you to the listeners who tune in each week, taking your chances on what you find, opening your mind. I'm Alex Smith, and I am grateful that you were there. All the musical sounds in today's show are The Desert Dwellers, courtesy of Black Swan Records. Find them at desertdwellers.org.